We're ready. All right. Well, then, welcome, Angie King. I'm so pleased, Angie, to be meeting you for the first time, even though last year when Miracle Creek published, you ended up signing a lot of books for us. So thank you. I'm also holding up a glass of champagne and a birthday card because today is your birthday.
Yay. Thank you so much. That's so nice of you. I love that. I definitely remember signing all of those books. I went to New York to FSG's offices and signed a whole bunch of books for you guys. And I'm so happy to actually see your bookstore, which I've heard so much about from my author friends who have gone through there. So thank you so much.
Well, I hope you will come and see us next time. Now, I have to tell you, you sent me a great photo of you signing all those books and your colleague who helped you do that told me he'd kill me if I posted the photo.
He did? What's wrong with him?
He said he made you promise never to share it, so I'm not sharing it.
He did, but it's actually not his face that's on it. It's only his arm that's on the picture, because I think he made me delete the one with his face in it, so I'm not sure why he's being ridiculous, but
well,
all right. We won't even mention his name, just in case.
No, we will not do that. And if that's true, I'll renegotiate. You may find me looking a little strange because I am used to talking to the TV screen where you are appearing in the bookstore instead of looking straight ahead into the camera. So that's why I keep veering off to the right, but I'll try to get with it. So let's talk about Miracle Creek, your debut novel. I could read a very nice synopsis, but maybe you'd rather just acquaint us with the setup for it yourself.
Sure, absolutely. And feel free to stop me because once I get going, I might just never stop. So Miracle Creek is my debut novel, and it is a literary courtroom drama of sorts about a Korean immigrant family and a young single mother who's on trial for murdering her 8-year-old autistic son. And it takes place in the fictional town in rural Virginia of Miracle Creek, Virginia. And it opens with an explosion in a hyperbaric oxygen therapy chamber, which is a real thing. It's an experimental medical chamber where there is a lot of pure oxygen around, and someone, we think deliberately, has set fire by the oxygen tanks, and people are killed and injured, and we immediately fast forward to a 4-day murder trial where the mother of a boy who has been killed in the fire and explosion is on trial for deliberately sabotaging the medical chamber so that she can be rid of this burden in her life.
Yes, that's a very complete summary. And it's clear that many of the incidents in the book arise from personal knowledge that you've acquired, some of it perhaps painfully yourself. But I wanted to introduce one thought to you, which you may not have, and it's because, you know, my first love is mystery. In its way, Miracle Creek is really structured like an Agatha Christie country house murder. You have a space with perimeters. You have the hyperbaric chamber instead of the country house. You have a cast of suspects who are present and they're hiding secrets. You have red herrings and you have a trial to bring things to justice. So really, you know, Miracle Creek is an interesting variation for me on a very classic form of detective fiction.
Oh, thank you. I am so glad to hear you say that because those classic mystery forms are actually my first love as far as American novels are concerned. So I am a Korean immigrant and I moved from Seoul to the Baltimore area when I was 11. And the only books that I was allowed to bring from Korea to Baltimore by my parents, just because we had limited space, was this beautiful set of hardcover mysteries, which were, you know, sort of English language mysteries that had been translated to Korean that I got as a birthday present when I was 10. So those included the sort of classic Agatha Christie's, as well as, you know, Dashiell Hammett and Edgar Allan Poe and things like that. And I read that over and over and over again when I was in America for like the first year that I was in America, when I didn't speak the English language, because those were like the only books that I had that I could actually read. And so I'm so glad that you noticed that structure, because I do think that rereading those over and over again, that mystery form really got sort of inculcated in me. Like it just became ingrained into my sort of psyche, if you will. So I'm glad that you noticed that. That's great. That was my intent.
Yes, well, I was going to ask you whether it was a subconscious or a conscious decision on your part to use the form, and you've really answered that. Do you think also the fact that you yourself are a lawyer would have helped shape this book in as much a mystery as, let's say, literary fiction? Because I think of it really as a mystery. In fact, you were one of our books of the month in last year as a mystery.
Oh, that's so great. I'm so happy to hear that. Yeah, I do think so. Definitely being a lawyer myself, and I was a trial lawyer, and being in the courtroom itself, doing all the things like cross-examining witnesses and, you know, and raising those objections and, you know, telling the stories to the juries as far as the opening and closing statements and things like that. That was my favorite part about being a lawyer. And I pretty much hated everything else about being a lawyer. And so I actually left the law pretty quickly. And I would say that that really shaped the structure of this novel a lot, because I knew immediately once I started thinking about writing this novel, my first novel, that I wanted it to be in this hyperbaric oxygen therapy chamber, because it's this dark chamber, and it's definitely the characters are sealed in this place. So there is this feel of a limited set of characters, you know, sort of like a classic Agatha Christie type of mystery. And red herrings possible and things like that. And I really thought about making it more of a detective type of novel, or a PI, you know, where somebody is in the days immediately following the incident of the fire and explosion, trying to figure out what happened. And I really thought, you know, even if we have to go forward a year in order to make it realistic that this is actually a trial that's happening, and it was that gap in time that I didn't know exactly how to handle. But I thought that going fast forwarding was actually better, just because then I could speak to sort of the courtroom drama and the twists, you know, that really naturally come in this courtroom setting, which I've seen myself and I have personal experience with. So I definitely thought about it for a long, long time, and even started writing it the other way, where it's really a detective story rather than a courtroom drama story. And I just came to the conclusion that I had to go with what I know and what I'm most comfortable with myself.
Well, Agatha Christie's Witness for the Prosecution is certainly a classic of a, you know, a courtroom trial.
With
surprises. You may not know, but I thought of it as soon as I thought about, started the book and read about the hyperbaric oxygen chamber, a very classic mystery by Christiana Brand called Green for Danger, in which oxygen, it's an operating room mystery, but oxygen is the key to it, and the murder is accomplished. Well, it's a spoiler, but I mean, this is a book that's like almost 100 years old, is accomplished by switching tanks of gas so that what looks like an accident in the operating room is actually a deliberate murder. But the point is that there's a lovely irony between oxygen, which is necessary for life, and oxygen, which then becomes an instrument of murder. And that was, I think, one of the reasons Green for Danger has always been such a classic, and one of the things that I really enjoyed about your book.
Oh, thank you so much. And I didn't remember the name of it, but I definitely am familiar with the story, because I thought of that as possibly one of the things that could go wrong. And I guess just as in so far as spoilers are concerned, you know, for the listeners, it possibly could be. So it's definitely gave me some ideas as far as exactly how did this incident come to happen. For the longest time, I actually thought of Miracle Creek not as a whodunit, but more as a whodunit. You know, right. how did this actually come to be? And that I definitely thought of sort of the oxygen tank and things like that in the role of figuring out how did this explosion even happen to begin with. So that's great that you noted that.
Well, in point of fact, you can't really write a whodunit if you don't have a how did they do it. So
exactly,
I think
you
always had to solve the how problem in order to get to the who problem. And, you know, and the question is, you know, was it an accident or was it something deliberately caused? And if it was murder, who was the real target? I mean, there's always that question too, is that, you know, occasionally what looks like a deliberate murder of one person turns out to have been, you know, aimed at another person and something went wrong. So there are lots of variations. You and I have something in common. I actually read the law in Virginia. I can't practice law in Arizona because I didn't go to law school. So I'm one of the last people that was actually able to practice law by reading the law, but I did almost all the work too. And I loved it. I love the drama of the courtroom. I loved, you know, the witnesses and the stories, but what you learn from that, which is what I hear you saying, really in the end, and especially before forensic evidence was so compelling, whoever told the best story in court really generally won the case, even in the face of actual facts that contradicted it. And I, you know, today we tend to think, you know, with all the science that we have, that surely, you know, the facts will lead us to the right conclusion, but every once in a while, we still get a verdict that doesn't relate much to the facts of the case, but rather to the emotional sway of the story that, you know, being told by either the prosecution or the defense.
Absolutely. And not only just the emotional sway, but just sort of the drama of it all, too. So who gives the most sort of dramatic and sympathetic version of the story too, and whoever can actually take all of the facts and the inferences that you can make from the facts and spin it into a story that actually makes sense and is sympathetic to real people. I always thought that that was the most important thing. And actually one of the things that made it so satisfying to actually be in court, because you're not just doing things like looking up precedents and past cases and, you know, doing more technical things, but rather using that skill of weaving a story, a narrative that really makes sense and telling that story. I always thought that, and I am so glad to hear you say that. This is great. And also, so how fun. I didn't even realize that that was possible to read law in Virginia, I guess. My husband is actually a Virginia lawyer. I'm actually a Maryland/DC lawyer. So I was never, even though I actually clerked for a judge in Virginia, but so interesting. That's great.
This was in the very late 70s and early 80s. Okay. And the way they worked it in Virginia, and we'll get off this in a minute, not bore your lyric. was that you had to be tutored by an attorney or a judge. In my case, it was a circuit court judge. And they had to monitor your program. But what was really fun, and then there was no public defender program really active in Southwest Virginia back then. So what they did is they rotated it around members of the bar, but he paid like $100 and found. And so since I was learning the law and I was working for free, I was like the most popular member.
Because
they could send me, I couldn't sign off on anything. You know, I couldn't run an actual trial on my own, but I could do a lot of grunt work, a lot of research. I could qualify witnesses. I could do whatever the presiding judge qualified me to do. And I ended up as a plaintiff in a giant medical malpractice trial, which I won, which is very hard to do. And that's why
that's
I have
amazing.
A bookstore, because I can afford it. So let's pause
that's
right
amazing.
Here.
That's amazing. I love that.
It is. It's an interesting story. Probably wouldn't work in a book, but there we are. Let me just check with Patrick to see if we have any questions at this moment.
No questions, but we are open. So if anybody has questions or comments, they're welcome to do so.
If anybody is watching this at the moment on Facebook Live and has questions, they are certainly welcome to ask them and Patrick will read them. Angie, one of the things I looked up and which I thought was a great comment is this: one of Stephen King's greatest gift as a writer is how he is completely unafraid to take risks with who his characters are. Angie Kim does the same, making her characters so real in their ugliness and their guilt, unafraid to show that parenting is an ugly job that sometimes has wonderful benefits. I thought that was a terrific comment. Do you agree with it?
I am so flattered by it completely. I'm completely agree about Stephen King, whom I had the great fortune to meet almost exactly a year ago, actually in early May of 2019, and definitely agree about the characters. And that was one of my goals, was really to sort of lay bare the sort of the good and the bad of parenting, especially parenting in sort of extreme circumstances, whether they be the fact that some people are trying to parent kids in a language other than their own, you know, in when they're immigrants, like much like the Yu family is in my novel, or the parenting in circumstances where they're dealing with medical disabilities or special needs of their children. And I did this crazy experimental HVOT, hyperbaric oxygen therapy thing for one of my kids, and did group therapy sealed inside this sort of crucible-like, you know, chamber of my own, and met with a lot of these other parents. And one of the things that that really struck me was how much love there is, but also how much frustration, just because there are a lot of these sort of shameful thoughts that parents have that they don't feel like that they can talk about, because they think that it makes them seem ugly and not good. And we do have this expectation of all mothers in particular needing to be saintly and amazing parents. And so I really wanted to go ahead and highlight that. And I'm really glad that you read that comment, because that's just hits it on the nail for what I try to do and hope to do.
Does this kind of therapy work best for children with autism, or does it work for a variety of diseases?
So, I mean, I'm not sure that I can say that it works in the sense that it's very controversial, because it is experimental. It's not been approved by the FDA for anything beyond sort of the more conventional treatments that you would see, these HVOT chambers that are in hospitals that are used for, so they're used in hospitals for things like carbon monoxide poisoning, and for gangrene, for wound healing. So those are the things that are the conventional treatments. And the things like treatment for autism and other sort of neurological types of disabilities, such as cerebral palsy, Lyme disease even, Alzheimer's, infertility, these are all things that I've seen used in my own experience. And I know that lots of people, you know, like to try them for them, but they are definitely not approved by the FDA for these things. And I have lots of friends who did this HVOT at the same place that I did it. And I did it for my child for ulcerative colitis. And at the end of the 40 treatments that we did with our child, he ended up outgrowing ulcerative colitis. So in a sense, it worked for him. But on the other hand, we were doing so many other things at the same time. So hard to know whether it was the HVOT itself that worked to heal, or whether it was sort of a coincidence. I have friends who have kids with cerebral palsy and autism, who will swear by this and say that it made such a huge difference. And I also have friends who will say they tried it and they were really hopeful, and while it didn't harm their child in any way, they didn't see any difference at the end of the, you know, 40 dives that they did. So it's hard to say either way.
Well, there's no one size fits all for most medical treatments. I mean, what works on one cancer patient doesn't work on another. I thought it might work well for autism because, you know, there'd be a certain sensory deprivation, or, you know, the sensory overload would be diminished. if you were in a very small enclosed space. I wasn't sure if the oxygen made any difference or whether it was simply the fact of being enclosed where the outside world doesn't impinge upon a child who is thrown off track by sensory overload.
Yeah, obviously, I think
you don't know either.
So. Yeah, the intent for this is because they do use, you know, sensory deprivation tanks and things like that, right, for anxiety and sensory overload and things like that. But I think the intent for HVOT for conditions like autism is to actually provide pure oxygen in a high pressure orientation, so that the nerves can actually be healed. And also there's a lot of, there are a lot of theories that autism has something to do with the gut and gut bacteria. And so the fact that you would be putting a lot of oxygen to certain anaerobic bacteria and things like that could help to balance the gut bacteria, and that could help the situation as well. So that's one of the theories also. So there are so many different theories. Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah.
It is interesting. I have spent time in Peru at Lake Titicaca 3 different times now, and you're at such an altitude that when you check into the great hotel there, first thing they do is put a thing on your finger to measure your oxygen level. And if it's not high enough, they pump pure oxygen into your room. The hotel is set up so that it actually creates. It's also true in Cusco in a couple of hotels that it creates. They also give you coca leaves to chew. You can legitimately take coke and I passed, so I never did have oxygen in my room. But I thought it was interesting that, you know, that was an option, and I wondered how it would feel. Let me hang on a minute. Anything else, PK, has come in? Not yet. All right. So you've done this really unusual novel. What is it you're thinking about doing next? Because I always think that a writer I like should not be a one-book writer. So I'd like to think you're writing something new.
I am definitely writing something new. I'm trying anyway. It's really hard. People have been saying, well, at least you have a lot of time to just focus on writing. And that is, you would think that would be true, except that it's just so, I'm so distracted and I can't seem to focus these days. So it's been hard. But the novel that I'm working on right now is called The Happiness Quotient. And it's about a little 10-year-old boy who is nonverbal with autism and apraxia. And he goes on a walk at the beginning of the novel with his father, who's his primary caregiver, but only the boy returns home. And because he's nonverbal, he can't tell the authorities or his family what happened during that walk.
Wow, so this is the variation on the amnesia. You know, the patient who wakes up with amnesia and cannot tell anybody what happened.
Right.
In your case, it's not an unreliable narrator, it's a disabled narrator, which is
exactly, yeah.
But I was just going to say, it sets up so much tension because, you know, the reader really wants this character to speak, but the character can't.
Absolutely. And, the narrators are actually his older siblings who are fraternal twins, one boy, one girl, around 17, 18 years old, who are just desperate to help this little boy, their little brother, to learn how to communicate. Because there are these new communication technologies and therapies for kids with autism and apraxia, typing and things like that, that really help to sort of get them to communicate. And so the siblings are really working with their little brother to try to figure that out. And so it's a lot about sort of communication, and it's also about the role that language plays in our society. I do think that, and I noticed this as somebody who immigrated from Korea and didn't speak English for a little while, I noticed how our society, and by our society, I don't mean just the American society, I just mean sort of like all humans, we place so much importance on language and on oral communication, that verbal fluency really influences how we think about intelligence. So if you're really fluent and you speak well, then we assume that you're very intelligent. And if you can't speak, even if it's because of a disability, even if you can, you have thoughts and you're intelligent and, you know, there are some other reason why you can't speak, we sort of assume that you're not intelligent and that you don't have thoughts worth sharing. And so that it's those types of dynamics that I'm also trying to really delve into as well.
Well, you're not setting yourself an easy task. However, the good news is that right at the moment in this situation we're in, where we're not doing any much face-to-face or personal communication, fluency, language either written or spoken, is even more important than it was. So,
right.
You know, that might help you. Are you, my final question then would be, I think, are you writing these kinds of books because you're expected to write something along these lines, or is it because this is what really interests you?
Oh, no, it's definitely because it interests me. In fact, both my agent and, you know, my editor, my publisher have been so open about not giving me any expectations or pressure about what's the next kind of book that I have to write. I think one of the blessings about Miracle Creek is that it is sort of genre bending. It doesn't neatly fall into one specific genre. So, you know, people have called it, you know, a courtroom drama. Certainly it is that, but it's also literary fiction about families, and it's also a murder mystery, and it's a little bit of a thriller. So because of that, I think they've given me sort of wide berth and said, you know, whatever you want to write, you can, without saying you must write X type of book next, you know, in order to sort of meet reader expectations. So it's been really nice that they've sort of given me that freedom. And I have so many ideas and so many different premises. And I've sort of asked them, what do you think I should do out of these ideas? And they're sort of like, whatever you want to do. So it's been really nice.
That is wonderful. One of the things that I've always loved about, I call it crime fiction rather than mystery, is that it's a very, very broad umbrella. You can go all the way, you know, you can talk about Dostoevsky or Victor Hugo or Dickens, whatever, and Anthony Trollope. I think that the fact that you are incorporating so many elements and not thus being classified as any one genre or being classified in various genres, however people think about it, it's a real advantage. So a drink to you. Happy birthday again.
Thank you so much
for joining us. It's really been a pleasure, Angie. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm so happy to meet you.
And I'm going down here to where it says end meeting. Goodbye.
Okay. Goodbye.